Terry, thought we'd start asking you about Kalgoorlie and growing up and playing hockey and then get into the international stuff.
Sure, no problem.
Okay.
The Kalgoorlie stuff is, before I went to Kalgoorlie, I was actually in Applecross in Perth and started playing there. My dad was a hockey player who played. My mum and dad came out from India back in the 30s, 40s, 46, I think they came out just as partition happened in India and Pakistan. But he was actually a pretty good hockey player. But my brother and myself played here in Perth, and then we went to Kalgoorlie. Dad was a primary headmaster, and we returned to Kalgoorlie as I was born up there. But did the circuit with the with Dad as a primary principal. So we ended up in Kalgoorlie, and I spent all my high school days in Kalgoorlie. So I remember playing on the grass and on the Crookshanks and doing all the lining of the gate, for the pitches and all the rest of it. So it was an interesting time. We had a really great development there because we played a lot of different sport, hockey being the primary one for me, but I played a few others, and just being able to play at another level up against adults fairly often. So that was all good fun. Had a really really interesting experience, and finally came down to Perth at the end of all of that, and started playing with YM down here in the first division competition of the Premier League or whatever. Changed his name a few times, and that's sort of the beginning days.
So your introduction to hockey in Perth, Terry, that was straight away into A grade hockey at YMCA, or why? Yeah.
When I came down after, I came down. They had a relegation match, as I recall, and David Hatt was the captain and leader of what was going on at YM, and the guys there at that stage. I remember Brian Glencross being around, and. I came down for a relegation match, I think in 71, and then I managed to get through, and then 72 I went down to Perth and we played, and we ended up doing pretty well that year in actual fact with Wayne.
Terry, had you been noticed as a junior in Kalgoorlie, or was it not until you got to Perth people sort of started looking at you as a player with some sort of potential?
I was selected in the under-16 state team from Kalgoorlie. I went away with that team she was 1968, I think. I was involved at that level, at junior level, and had been sort of touted, I guess, as a possible option going forward. So that's sort of the initial piece of it, and then I was a pretty quick athlete and all of those sort of things, which always helps when you're playing sport. And I was lucky. I was able to get a foot in the door, as it were, with from a selection point of view, and then one thing led to another, and very quickly after that we went into senior hockey. So yeah, the answer was I guess I went straight into the senior environment when I came from Kalgoorlie to Perth.
So to ready you to step up to that kind of level at a young age, were there any particular coaches that stood out from your time earlier on?
We played in the adult competition in Kalgoorlie, so I was the difference, I guess, was the refinement and the quality. But there were some good players. Speedy Rook had played up there earlier on, and there was a bunch of guys who played a lot of hockey out there, Barry Patterson and co, Terry O'Meara. There were really a lot of people who were around, and we garnered a whole lot of younger guys in the schools and the clubs to play. We didn't have a lot of teams there. We only had four or five teams, but it was a pretty full-on competition, and of course we also played in the junior competition as well. So the level was well short, I guess, of what the Perth First Division level was, but I was able to hold my own, probably because of my athleticism more than anything else.
For people who don't know, Terry, at that time, how would you describe Kalgoorlie for listeners that may not be aware of the town itself?
Well, it was a gold mining town, and it had been enhanced a lot with nickel in Kambalda. back in that era, and probably most people who have any history of the WA world in any of the geology, I guess, was that Kambalda became the nickel centre, and we had things like Poseidon and so on around the place, and the big share market piece jumped up, and I always remember the number of four-wheel drives running backwards and forwards in Kalgoorlie at that time. So it was very much an active mining town, but we didn't see it so much as that. We used to rush around and use the gold mining or the dirt that was spewed out from the remains of what went on in gold mining, made these big, really high slime dumps, basically, they were. That's what we refer to them. We used to cycle, use our bikes around there a fair bit. And that was, it was just part of what went on. You know, as I was going into uni and so on, I used to spend my time up there in the holiday periods working on the mines and trying to help out, earn a bit of pocket money on the Great Boulder and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was definitely a mining town, but there was a huge amount of sport that was played. It was just everywhere, and it wasn't anywhere near like it is today with such where we have synthetic pitches up there, but also reasonable grass pitches around the place. It was pretty tough, but it was great, really, really enjoyable time to come up in the sport.
Now, to move on to your career leading into playing with Australia, Terry, our co-host here, Matt, dug out a lovely piece from a hockey bulletin in which it's probably the first time hockey people saw your name, and it was in a junior carnival where you'd scored 5 goals.
Phew. I can't even remember.
It was a state game.
I remember playing for junior carnival down in Busselton or Bunbury, the Bunbury Junior Carnivals, a bit, but not a lot in the early days. But yeah, look, I don't know where that was from, whether that was a Kalgoorlie piece or a Perth piece.
No, I don't want to give away your age on it, Terry, to be honest, but it was...
look, I don't have a problem about my age. I was born in 53, so you can do what you like with your age. You just, that's the way it works.
So, yeah, it was a WA Colt, I think it was. You travelled to 1972, so you'd... in assessing individual performances, 3 players were outstanding: Terry Walsh, YMCA, Steve Smith, Old Modernians, and Bruce Shanahan, Old Aquinians. Terry Walsh scored 5 goals and was the driving force in the forward line. But there's
you finished
third in the final rankings in that competition.
Well, there you go. Yeah, the competitions were thick and fast. I mean, the guy I went through my career with was David Bell. He and I sort of got into the next level, the national level, at the same time, and our careers sort of mirrored each other right through. That whole era of the Davies and Hazelhurst and Charlesworth and so it went. We had a whole bunch of guys, Terry Leese and co, who played for long, Craig Boyce, Grant Boyce, that era, along with Shanners and Steve Smith and co. We went right through that junior era as well as into the senior group, and then on to a couple of us went into the Australian environment as well.
Terry, looking back now, do you see that particular period of time in Perth specifically as one of the great, almost like a little mini dynasty? The players that were coming out of Perth and Western Australia at that time were dominating, and in many ways have continued to dominate hockey in their post-game career, post-player careers.
Well, it was an interesting one because, there was a lot of good players at that point in time in WA, and my time with one of them, David Bell, we played under 11s and under 13s at Applecross Primary School, or not Applecross Primary, but the Applecross Hockey Club, which was we never knew what was in front of us down the track, but I ended up going away into Kalgoorlie and then coming back, and David was, of course, Dibsy was very big in cricket as well, and he ended up sort of moving in towards hockey, and was obviously one of the best right halves we ever had in the Australian side. So we had a lot of players who were around when we had a national team competition. A huge number of national players at that point, like Pooley and Charlie and Hazel, and there were just a bunch of them, too many to go through in name. They ended up in the Australian side either previously or beyond. But the guys who I remember in my playing days, early playing days in YMCA were Donnie Smart. Donnie Smart's the best individual coach I've ever had. He was just fantastic. He was a great guy and a really nice person and a fantastic individual coach. We spent a lot of time together. Bag, Brian Glencross, was down there as well. He obviously had a whole lot to provide, and he was a really good guy to follow through. David Hatt was another player, and quite frankly is the best captain I ever played under. He was really, really an outstanding mover of men, if you like. He could really manipulate people very effectively in a timely fashion. So, I was really lucky with the people that I started with in YMCA. That gave me a huge benefit. And then I had the Craig and the Grant Boyces and Co, who I basically grew up with in that era, Terry Lees and Co. We did have a really good group of players, both in the club environment and then in the state environment and through into the national environment. We were a bunch of young guys who didn't know where we were going, I don't think, when I first started my Olympic program in 76. We were a very young group, and lo and behold, we ended up losing the final to New Zealand, which was the only game we'd lost for a long, long time to New Zealand, and did since then. We've been pretty dominant over New Zealand, but they won the gold medal, and deservedly so on that day. But there were a whole lot of backdoor stories that go on with all of that. But the biggest piece at that moment was that was probably the beginning of particularly India and Pakistan finding it very, very difficult at the very highest level. Yeah. Pakistan sustained for a lot longer, but India fell right away. India now are starting to come back a bit, and Pakistan is still struggling. So it's been an interesting 30 years of hockey programming, I guess, on the international scene.
We'll get back to that point, Terry, because there's something we're going to bring up a bit later. But just looking at your own career, you played for the senior state team in 1974. You made your debut, and a year later you find yourself at a World Cup playing for Australia in the senior team. Did that seem like a natural progression to you, or was it a bit of a shock?
Bit of a shock. I mean, that was pretty quick, I think. Normally you would expect to take a bit longer to go through the system, but I guess it was more of an indication that it was time for a change with the Australian group. And the Australian group were pretty successful. Yeah, look, I think it was a bit beyond the norm. I don't think people really go through that process very often, but it's quite amazing when you do get an opportunity to do it, because you just move from one environment of high level and you go into another. And I was lucky. I was one of the lucky ones who was able to, still stand on my feet at the next level. And so often in sport, you see this happen where people go to another level and there's a ceiling that they have in their playing levels. And sometimes it's sort of first division versus second division. Sometimes it's first division versus state. Sometimes it's state versus national and international sort of levels. They're all different, and it's a mixture of just ability, but quite often it's not just the playing ability. Usually it's to do with the mental makeup of the player, I think.
Did those early days in Kalgoorlie perhaps help you in that mental side of not being pushed around?
Well, probably. I mean, I remember we did a huge and a very expensive national survey on what the best athletes had in their background, and two of the major things that came out of that very expensive AIS survey a long time back, would have been in the 80s, was talking about kids who played in the country environment and played multiple sports. Now that sounds very trite, really, when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of things that go along with that, and our history in WA hockey. We had a lot of WA country boys who were playing in the high level hockey. Relatively, you know, people came out of the country environments in a relatively large number. So, yeah, I think it does have a bit to do with it, to be quite honest.
Do you notice that in some of the other countries you've been to? Or is it something specific, say, to Australia that we get so many people from outside of the main population centres?
Hard to know. It really is hard to know because Australia is such a different country to many of the others. You know, you've got your cities and you've got your towns. And a lot of the towns are big enough to handle, you know, sport in its own right. A lot of the other countries, they tend to be, you know, if you take Holland, for example, then you don't have this difficulty with travel. You can go wherever you like in the country. But I guess India or the US sort of hit it fairly closely with reference to the geography, you know, having to travel a long way to do anything. And totally different pictures in both countries compared with Australia. So it's for me, it's impossible to try and make that same categorization, you know, from Australia to others. But my sense is that the human nature would be that if you get exposed at an earlier age and learn the coping strategies of being able to play against someone who's twice your size and twice your age and all of those sort of things, and put up with the normal, not just the physical stuff, but the mental stuff, you know, being the young upstart and being maligned accordingly, you know, because a lot of those guys think that makes a bit of difference. Yeah, I think you just learn to cope with all those things at a much earlier time than you otherwise would.
So back to those early days, 1975, you've gone into the international program. What was the setup like then? How often did the players get together? You know, what were the routines?
Well, the routines were sort of non-routines, to be quite honest. You just played in your club environment in Perth, as it were, and then if you in the national team, you were lucky to be selected from the national championships, and you waited for the results of that at the end of those. If you're lucky enough to be in the team, then you might meet the rest of the guys going to a tournament in Singapore and just go across to the tournament. And that was it, really. And if you did that two or three times a year, that was a reasonable amount. Now, the things that changed, of course, is the frequency of events. So you played on a more regular basis as you went through in the last 30 years. And so guys who played 100 caps back in the 60s, well, hardly any of them did because there just weren't enough games for them to play. There were only a handful of games a year. So you had people like Julian Pearce, who I regarded as probably the best hockey player I've seen come out of Australia. He just wasn't able to play too many games because he had a career that he had to look after and then had to match it in with the very, very meager number of tournaments that people played at that time. So the guys who played 40 and 50 games in that era compared with guys who played 300 games in today's era plus, it's pretty hard to get your head around all of that, plus the combination of hockey now becoming a semi-professionalised sport, if you like.
Terry, you mentioned earlier Montreal, which was 1976, your first Olympic Games. What sort of preparation did you go through then? Were you in a camp beforehand, or did you just roll up, as you mentioned before, in Montreal?
Well, we actually we had a bit of a camp here in Perth before we went to Pakistan. We actually went to Pakistan in the very early part of 1975, and then went to the World Cup following that. And Pakistan was a real eye-opener. We'd never been. This was my first international tour, and when I say we, quite a few of us were in that boat. We went across into Pakistan, went through a lot of the back areas of Pakistan, which was just an unbelievable hockey country and had a culture of playing the sport where, they were just unbelievably good. And they had lots of them who could play really, really well, and they could run at 100 mile an hour in one direction and turn at right angles while we kept running into the wall. You know, they were just unbelievably good, and they played on clay, and so they could... we were all used to playing on grass, but they played a lot of their hockey on the clay surface, and we played a few games in that type of environment, but mainly in grass. But we experienced, you know, a whole change in the way that we went about what we did as a game playing in Pakistan, and I think that was one of the best things we ever did, to be quite honest, in that era, was to get away. And actually, when I was involved with the Institute, we in the early days, we wanted to go to Pakistan and into India, because we felt that that was a, if you want to call it hardship, it was a hardship that you had to learn to live with and still perform on a daily basis. And it was the lifeblood of a lot of people in those countries. Hockey was a big game, it was a big sport, and so to play in front of big crowds, as it were, possible to do in the early days when you played internationally. You could play in front of 50,000-60,000 without too much trouble. And a lot of things change, most notably their ability to stick with it at the highest level, and so their level of performance dropped away, and so did the crowds. It was a direct correlation there over the period that I was involved. But it was a very good experience. So we went to Pakistan. We went right around Pakistan to places like Shikarpur and Sagoda. The names still stick in my mind, as well as the Multans and the Lahores and the Karachis, and further up to Islamabad and so on. So it was a great experience for a bunch of young guys. And many of the stories that when we get together nowadays, and when we do talk, it takes us back into that part of our lives. Not so much on the hockey pitch, marginally, but what was going on off it. It was really quite an experience.
So who were the teams that you were playing against in Pakistan?
We just played against Pakistan. Right. We played against regional teams as well as we went around, but it seemed as though it was the same group of players to us that were travelling around on the plane. But it was basically just Pakistan over there. Argentina, I recall, were touring there at the same time, before the World Cup, which was in 1975 in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. So it was a very interesting period of time, but it was a really hugely important development period for that group of players, I think, that we had in that team.
So then it was straight on to Montreal after the Pakistan trip?
No, Pakistan, we went to the World Cup in 1975, and then 1976 was the Olympics, and we were still very much, you know, were teaching or doing whatever our profession allowed us to do, and then we'd get away, we'd leave without pay to go on some of these big events. And of course the Olympics is, I guess, the biggest event you can go to, and certainly the biggest multi-sport event, and is totally different from a World Cup in hockey, because World Cup, of course, is just one sport, and it's all hockey. But when you go to the Olympics, it's just it's a totally different experience. You have a multiple setting in the sport environment. Many of these people are just, they're icons in their own right. At that time, most of those big names stayed inside the village. Today, most of them don't, but at that time, most of them stayed inside the village. So it was really much, very much of a very interesting setup, and something very hard to explain. But it certainly gives you a good dose of humility when you're there, because you're sitting alongside a lot of very, very famous people in their sporting environments.
Terry, you went to two Olympics. You were at Los Angeles as well. But squeezed in between Montreal and Los Angeles is, of course, Moscow. And the Australian hockey team didn't compete at Moscow. Is that, perhaps looking back now, a decision that you regret the authorities made? Or what sort of effect did it have on the players?
Well, politics and sport probably don't mix. They never have, they never will, and it didn't then. I mean, we'd made a decision at that point that we would go, and it was left up to us by our government to the team. We were totally in agreement that we would go, and we were training. And I remember just a couple of weeks before we left, we had received all our equipment and all the bits and pieces to go, and then the decision was made to pull the rug under that and from under the feet of the national team. We had a very good side too. We had a good chance of winning, I think, in 1980. But it wasn't to be. Very, very disappointing. And it's still something that sits, you know, sadly in the memory. But you understand how all these things happen. As you get older, you realise that a lot of things are literally out of your hands, and quite often out of the hands of many other people as well. And decisions get made for obscure reasons. But from what I've found out, it wasn't a very sensible reason anyway. That the whole thing happened, it was very much politicised. And my memory of the whole deal was that the Pakistan piece, sorry, it wasn't Pakistan, it was Afghanistan, I think, was invaded theoretically by Russia. And I remember we had some people in Pakistan that we spoke to when we left there one time. We heard that this big invasion had taken place, and we spoke to them, and they were pretty good friends over a period of years that we had at that time. And they said, look, there's nothing different that's going on. It was just fairly highly politicised, but that's what happens. I mean, I guess politics is a strange animal. I've never understood it and don't pretend to, but it certainly changes the way people behave.
Now, moving on from that, you also suffered something of a serious knee injury, and perhaps at a time when why medicine had decided that they could fix those problems, they haven't quite figured out exactly how they were going to fix these problems.
Yeah, well, I did an ACL. I was playing. I still remember it vividly, playing against Ireland at the Perth Stadium, and just trying to turn 180 degrees. Very quickly, and it just didn't work. So I blew the knee out, and they said, "Oh, look, you need to probably have a reconstruction on your knee," which I sort of looked around for and didn't find terribly much information about. And at that time, they were doing this new process, which actually had carbon fibre involved, they'd just sutured here and there and everywhere and joined things up, and I thought, no, I don't think that's a wise thing to do. So I ended up with our physio, Graham Reed. I got a brace that was then very, very, very new on the NBA scene in American basketball, and I managed to get hold of one of these braces and did a huge amount of work strengthening hamstrings particularly and quads, and using this brace and using an Orthotron, as it was then. I used to use that three or four times a week, and gradually managed to get back to a reasonable place and managed to get back into the team. And only last year, in actual fact, I decided that I was told that by the time I got to 45, I'd need a complete knee replacement. Now, I was still fairly mobile, had a few problems, but last year I decided to get it completely replaced, so I did that, and that's where I am now. But yeah, I was very lucky to be able to continue to play with an injury like that for such a period of time. But the people around me were the ones who allowed me to, you know, to get the not the treatment, but the work ethic, I guess, and push that pretty hard to make sure that I was able to at least give myself a chance to play.
I do remember you playing in that knee brace. It was like a big pillow, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was fairly large. It was a sort of a concoction of plastic bands and a lot of Velcro strips and so on, and big rubber bands that went across, and pieces underneath to stop the chafing. And so you wore a sleeve underneath and over the top of the brace. So it looked a little bit cumbersome, and but it was okay. It held up and stopped that lateral movement of the knee. So you could do most things reasonably well. It still impeded what you could do before, but you just learned what you could and you couldn't do, and you worked appropriately within the boundaries.
Now, your final game for Australia as a player was the 1986 World Cup.
Yep.
Is that right? And for anybody that's interested, there's vision on YouTube of you scoring the winning goal in that particular game. Do you have any your memories of that moment?
I do. I remember it vividly, in actual fact, because I remember JB, Johnny Bestel, scored a corner after that, and we ended up winning 2-1. But the moment was vivid in my mind. I remember the ball coming from the left side on a long corner, as it was in those days. You hit it out from the corner, and it went around the back inside the circle and onto my right side, and the ball basically bounced in front of me. And I remember Ian Taylor, who was the goalkeeper from England. He was an outstanding goalkeeper, and we had all sorts of issues in 1984 at the Olympics. We had a bunch of penalty corners. We had 22 penalty corners or something for the third and fourth playoff game, and we really messed it up, and we probably should have won the gold medal in that year. We didn't, and we didn't win the bronze medal either. And the bronze medal failure was fairly well a Taylor proposition. It was outstanding on the penalty corners, and we weren't so efficient, I don't think. But needless to say, in 86 we had our chance again, Taylor in the net, and so there was a bit of history there. But I remember the ball bobbling, and it was sort of between knee and waist height, and I thought, well, I'm just going to knock this into the corner, but Taylor might get this with an outstretched leg if I sort of hit it down. So I deliberately knocked it into the ground, into the turf, so he'd have to go with his leg, and it would hit the turf and just bounce up into the air, and he couldn't do anything about it because he'd have an outstretched leg. And that's exactly what happened, and it seems slow motion to me still today. But I remember that vividly, and it's really, really slow in my own mind. But I have seen the goal again, obviously, and it happens pretty fast. But it's amazing what the mind can do.
Was that one of your better goal celebrations?
I really don't know. I sort of enjoyed scoring goals. I remember one of the best goal scoring, not a celebration, but I remember hitting a goal and I didn't even bother watching whether it went in or not. I was facing the wrong way and I just smacked it in and just tucked the stick under my arm and walked back to the centre. But yeah, look, you remember odd things, and not necessarily in the very top competition that you play in, but the camaraderie and the people around you, and the tales that are told, you know, with all of that, I think is one of the major things that keeps you together over a long period of time when you're playing on the international scene. And that was the case. We were really lucky to have a great group of people, both on and off the pitch, within the group, who were really supportive, and yeah, we were fortunate to be successful as well. So it was a great era.
Now, from there, Terry, you moved into coaching. Was that something that you'd thought about before you retired, or and had a plan with, or something you fell into?
Well, I sort of fell into it to a degree. I was teaching, and Richard Aggas was the then national coach, and he was invited to be the head coach of the Australian Institute of Sport, which was set up in Perth. And Dodger, as we knew Richard, Dodger said or asked me if I'd be interested in being a coach in the system, and I was still playing at that point. And I agreed, and I came out of the teaching world and went into the Institute in 1984 in Perth, which was its first year, and indeed it was the first decentralised AIS program in Australia. So we went in there and we basically initiated what's now been a long-standing AIS program centralised in Perth. So that was when I started my coaching career, and since then, of course, I finished up in 86, and then I did different Olympic programs with different countries. But I've been to, I don't know, 8 or 9 Olympics, I guess, now, so in different areas of coaching, and you know, I've been lucky. I've coached some really good teams around the world. You know, some really high level teams, and I've really enjoyed it. The experience has been very, very different, and I've seen the game evolve, and I've seen different teams evolve in different ways. But I've been around in it for a long time now, because that started in '84. What are we now? 17. So it's been a fair while. Been a fair while in the professional coaching environment.
So you're currently involved with Malaysia. You first started out there as head coach in 1990?
Yeah, I went to Malaysia in 1990. I coached the Australian junior team in 1989 in a place called Ipoh in Malaysia. And the Malaysians invited me to be the national coach in 1990, which I took up. They hadn't been in the Olympics for a while, and we managed to get them into the Olympics in 1992, and finished up in 1993. Four out of Malaysia came back to Australia, went back into the Institute, and then all sorts of things happened. Then I went away and coached in America as a consultant with their women's program. I came back and then coached the Australian national team. Being the head of the AIS and also the Olympic program for 2000, then finished, as I thought, with coaching, went into technology. I was heavily involved in a program called Sports Code, which is just a non-linear editing, as it was known right in the early days, program, which allowed us to get to bits and pieces of video and do analysis. And I was very heavily involved in that, in the coaching side of it, in the development phase of the program. And Donnie Pryor was also involved between the writer, the guy who actually did all the writing of the program, and myself with all the concepts and ideas, I guess. And I went out of coaching after 2000 and went into what had been taken over by a group called Sports Tech with Philip Jackson and co. And I did a lot of work around the world, just talking to big sporting organizations about using sports analysis, video sports analysis, with this program. And now it's used fairly comprehensively around the world, I've got to say. In the NBA it's used, and Australian football is used comprehensively. It's world football, soccer, it's used by a lot of the big teams now. So it's been exciting. Then I somehow or other ended up in coaching Holland in 2004, which was a really strange experience, because they had all sorts of internal problems in going into 2000, at the end of 2003, and they asked me to coach their national team for Athens. So they had to qualify for that. I took the role, and we qualified, and I got through. The team got through to Athens, and that was the most bizarre situation of all, because we ended up playing Holland in Holland played Australia in the final. It was really quite amazing. Australia won, so it was a very sad for Holland, but I didn't know which side of the fence to have my feet, so I was sort of it was just a very, very strange moment in my coaching career.
So how does that feel for a coach with the divided loyalty, your employer versus your country?
I just think it's the professional side of things. You just do what you have to do. I mean, I was particularly proud of the Australian side for winning the Olympics. I know how hard it is to win the Olympics. It's just a very, very difficult task. And as a player, never, ever succeeded in doing so. I think it's a really tough environment. And to Baz, who'd come in after me, and all the players I knew pretty well, they're either just coming into the scene or they're already there from 2000. It was quite an interesting time. It's probably not an experience you can talk about easily, but because unless you understand the difference between standing in front of a flag and listening to the national anthem of another country whom you're coaching, and then listening to your own country, and the national anthem. That's simplistically what it is. And I mean, in the end, you never ever would walk away and turn your back on the Australian national anthem, and I never have. But equally, I respect totally the national anthems of all countries, but particularly those who I've coached.
So then a move to the States, and you know, we obviously see the USA women have come on leaps and bounds, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years. Do you see that being some of the groundwork that you put in those earlier days coming to fruition?
No, USA is a very different kettle of fish. It's its own style of programming. It's got the best women's programming in the world with reference to colleges. They, if you can play hockey reasonably well as a female and you're relatively smart, you can get a college scholarship there, and it's the best program around. It really, really is very, very good. In my view, it doesn't happen for men at all in America, so it's virtually all the women's side. But I went there as a technical director, and I did a lot of work in the development phase and tried to get them to understand a little bit more about the culture of the game and how to play it. I worked at grassroots level through to college level, and obviously was involved with the national program as well, both the women and the men. In actual fact, pretty hard work with the men. I remember going there, and we only had about 25 or 26 players, and we finished up with several hundred, but we did okay with the men. I mean, the men were, I remember having success at beating Argentina and beating Canada and so on and so forth. That was quite an experience. But the women's program was the major one, and there wasn't any doubt that from that side, there's no doubt that we set a huge base network for them, I think that's part of what's going on now. They let it lapse, all the development of the coaching, but I think they're trying to reinstitute it now. But yeah, I'm sure that Lee Bottomead, and who was the national coach in America, made a huge impact with the way that the game has developed.
And is there a future for the men's game in the United States?
I think it's really hard to be anything but pragmatic about it. No, I think it's very, very difficult when you've got ice hockey and you've got American football and you've got basketball and baseball. It's pretty hard to find other sports, but they've found a few others. You know, they've got soccer going, and that's up and running, but it's hockey is not one of the hockey runs so close to their hockey is ice hockey, you know, and it's not something you can break into. And unless you've got a college appeal, that is, you can get a scholarship to go into colleges to play the sport. American sport's very different. Basically, kids play sport a little bit when they're younger. They get into colleges and they really start to play sport. And at the end of their college experience, that's it, they finish. And they're either a professional athlete, a professional player of some sort, or they're done. So I think the situation in America is very, very different. They can become a huge powerhouse in women's hockey if they really put their mind to it. There's no question about that. But the world of our sport is really, it's an interesting place that we find ourselves today. Everyone's striving to be, you know, a professional from the point of view of financing the players to be able to play as a livelihood, and that's a pretty big ask for our sport, and I'm not sure really whether or not we're capable of being able to provide that.
Is there the commercial interest in the women's game in America?
If they were successful, yes. If they were successful internationally, there's no question that could come along. But you've got to be successful, and that means as their women's football or soccer has been, and their basketball, of course, with the women's basketball program, it doesn't draw anything like the NBA. But you know, they still have professional leagues, as they do with pretty well everything else. But the college system is where it all happens. The college system is just an amazing animal in its own entity. It's just incredible. It's like a mini Olympics every week that they have for football games and so on. I remember going to the college football game and being a guest with in Michigan, you know, 100,000 plus people just at a college football game. Just incredible, just amazing to see how it works and how it ticks over. The American sporting machinery is just very different to anywhere else in the world that I've seen sport being used as a tool for incomes, if you like, for athletes and for players. It's huge. It's really, really big.
Sorry, Terry, there's no doubt that the college system is the basis of everything to do with athletics in America. I mean, that, there wouldn't be any athletes in America if there was not a college system.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're absolutely right. The issue is, of course, that the greater the NCAA becomes, and you've got to remember the NCAA is just being peppered all the time with legal suits. It's got more legal suits than any other sporting body, as well as being the biggest sporting body probably in the world. It's it provides an enormous basis for youngsters to develop. And then in the professional sports like basketball, and kids at high school are having to make the choice, do I go to college and go through that process, which puts me out of the realm of going into the next stage of international, or, you know, the NBA of basketball, and untouchable, if you like, in the college system, or theoretically untouchable. I'm not sure that they are untouchable. All these young footballers and so on in basketball, in colleges, seem to drive around in big cars and live in big houses. So I don't know how that works, but they're not supposed to be financed at all. But that's the system, you know, it's the system. And like every other system, you have an opinion on it, but in the end, your opinion, you have to understand how the culture works. And most of the time, the culture is at loggerheads with your own culture, and you have to always put that aside. Otherwise, it just doesn't work for you. You just it's too hard if you try and bring your own culture into another culture and try and change things accordingly. Just in my view, that's a very dangerous thing, and probably be one piece of advice I'd have for coaches who do go internationally, and that is, you don't try and change the way things work too much. However, if countries want you to make change, there has to be a relative equation, if you like. There has to be change made, otherwise you don't bring about change. It's pretty simple. So it's a very tight line that you walk. You don't want to step across it too much, I don't think.
Well, it's a perfect segue into your experiences with India and the hockey culture and the wider culture there. Can you tell us a little bit about your time there?
Yeah, look, that was a fantastic experience, because India in our sport is the history of our sport, if you like, is Indian hockey. And we've always, in my era, we used to absolutely just put everything down to go and see a game between Pakistan and India. It was just what you wanted to do and what you wanted to see. And we were very fortunate, because the Australian team playing against Pakistan became that sort of game back in that era, back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. That was really the game that people wanted to see. Those three teams play, because of the way that they played, in a very offensive, risk-taking way, if you like. And the Indian way, of course, is very artistic. The flamboyance and the artistry of being able to redirection the movement or eliminate a player, that's what people went to watch. They didn't go to watch something with power and all the rest of it. They're not interested in that. They're really looking for the artistry and the ability to see people do things that are really, really clever. And that's still in parts of India exists today. A lot of people want to see that, and of course you can't win internationally and be really effective if that's the only way you play. You have to combine that and in my view, I used to refer to it as the Indian Marsala with the team, and a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and they were able to bring that. We managed to discipline them enough to be able to use some of the, let's call them the Western way of playing hockey, some of the disciplines that you require to actually play the game effectively, but still leaving an opening so that they could use this exciting and unpredictable piece of the game, which really brought to light the spectators. And I thoroughly enjoyed that part of it, being able to try and combine the two without trying to totally overrun them with a Western style or the Australian style, or indeed, as is the case, the European style. I think that just kills the lifeblood of the Indian game. And so the Indian style of game is just incredible. The ability to do things with the ball and set people off balance and make movement patterns and so on is really, really delightful. But their ability to be disciplined is equally frustrating because they just they can be disciplined for a period of time, and then all of a sudden, when it's most critical, they seemingly push the undisciplined button, you know, and do something that's totally against. Now, if you can match it well, I think you can create a really good group. And my most successful time with the Indians, I mean, we were able to win the Asian Games and so on with the Indian team. I was only there for 12 months, but we changed things around enough to be able to get some results. But the best time of watching them play was when they were here in Perth, which was my last time with the Indian side. They played some really, really watchable and dynamic hockey, you know, as did the Australian guys as well. But the Indian guys, I thought, were outstanding. They did some really, really good things, and I'm well aware that the Australians didn't have their very best side. So it wasn't as though it was Australia versus India in the top context. But just watching the Indians play and bringing some of the artistry and the grace of the game combined with some of the disciplines that are required to play the modern game, I think that was one of my cherished coaching periods.
So you had some time with Kalinga Lancers in the Hockey India League, and you just talked a little bit about the cultural blend between the Indian style and maybe some of the more Western ways. Do you think Hockey India League's having a positive impact on Indian hockey?
Oh, I think it has. There's no question that having a lot of players come in from outside has had a fairly impactful outcome on the sport in India. The question is, where is it going? And that's a dilemma that I think our sport faces, you know, across the globe. The situation is that, you know, you've got players earning $100,000 US for 6 or 8 weeks or whatever of playing the game. And I still remember my time with the Kalinga Lancers when I was involved in this process, this whole bidding process for players. And I insisted that the lowest level of payment was $2,400 or $2,800 US, which all went to the Indian players. So if you got an Indian player, that's what they got. And I thought that was really unfair, really, really unfair. And I was quite happy to live with a fairly low amount for a couple of the youngsters who we had with the Kalinga Lancers, which I put down as 6,000. But the minimum other than that was 8,000 for these players, in my view, because it was not fair to have someone playing for $2,800 and another player playing for $70,000. I mean, it's pretty hard to control a team when you've got that discrepancy just in the incomes. And in that culture, in that place, finances are huge. They're really, really important. And we all understand the difference between, you know, the income relatively in Holland to that of India, or that of Australia and India or Argentina and so on. But they're all different, and I think you have to be respectful of that. And I remember making a stance on that at that point, which was not well received necessarily by the administration, but I thought it was very important to, you know, to at least enhance the income of the kids from India to a level which I thought was in somewhat a more commensurate way than what was set up. But yeah, it's doing a good job. What's going to happen? I don't know. I mean, I watched the last Indian League, and I know they're having trouble with getting franchises, and the difficulty with the whole piece. I hope it does continue. I really do hope it continues. Also, we started a league in Malaysia at roughly the same time, and the money's nowhere near the same, but there's money there for players to earn if they want to go and play in the Malaysian league, and that's going to grow, I'm sure, over the period. And certainly they get much more money playing in the Malaysian league than they do get playing in the Perth League, for example. And so opportunities are going to be there, but in the end it's going to be a dollar-driven game, because to have the professional players means you've got to pay a fair bit of money out. And a lot of the solutions we see in sports like rugby, it's very, very expensive, and you've got to be very careful how much you spend on the very top tier and the money you don't spend in your development. Because if you want your players to come through in quality, then you have to have a development program that somehow works. And we all know that things have changed. The volunteer in the sporting world today, working in clubs, they're far fewer. They used to be everywhere. Everybody got volunteered their time, but no more. People don't volunteer their time anywhere near the way that they used to, and so costs keep escalating. And you try and put 15 or 20 people on a plane to go anywhere, it doesn't matter whether they're old, young, green, black, blue, you know, it costs you a lot of money to get on a plane. And when you start playing international sport and you want to play things like home and away competitions, there's a huge amount of money that gets given to the travel industry.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, Terry, your career started playing on grass. You saw the transition from traditional hockey, let's call it, to what might be called synthetic hockey these days. And the skills, it must be said, are tremendous. The players today are tremendously athletic and they're very skillful, except I think in the area of trapping. And it irritates me. It irritates me constantly to see blokes lying their stick, or women, flat on the ground to stop a ball and it bounce over the top.
Yeah, I think it's a good observation. I think a lot of the time people don't understand what receiving the ball is all about. A lot of people are either coached or they learn that receiving the ball is basically stopping the ball going in that direction and then being able to restart it going in another direction after you've stopped it. Not many learn the art of being able to receive the ball in a mobile fashion and move off, particularly if it's bouncing, you know, having things like your left hand in front of your right, towards, so your left hand's close to where the ball's come from, so your stick's actually on an angle and going downwards, but it's virtually vertical. And having your eye, the ball, and the stick all in the one plane, those things are seemingly old-fashioned, but they work a lot. They work really, really well, and I'll give you a very good example of it. And in 2004, in the final at the Olympics between Australia and Holland, Holland are horrific across the board at receiving a bouncing ball. They don't know how to do it. They put their feet together and stand in a vertical way, upright behind the ball. And the reason I mention that is because in the last game in Athens at the Olympics, it was a very windy night, and it basically dried out the pitch, and the pitch was terrible to say the least to begin with, but without any moisture on it, it was horrific, and the ball would just scuttle all over the place and bounce and bobble. And the Australian guys could trap very, very effectively, and on the international scene it's fair to say the Australians are better than most. So I'm glad you don't live in Holland or somewhere like that, otherwise you'd be furious about this sort of receiving technique. But the ability to get your left elbow up in a cricketing type fashion is easy for the Pakistanis and the Australians, even the English, and Australians, we do that very, very easily. But for countries who don't have that ability to put their left elbow up and play a defensive cricket stroke type thing, it's not natural. And they find it very, very difficult. And the Europeans particularly just lie their flat out stick on the ground, and a lot of our youngsters do as well. Last time I coached in Perth, first division team, we actually trained once a week on grass specifically so that people learned how to trap the ball a little better and cope with the ball being able to move in a slightly unpredictable manner on the pitch. So I agree with you. I think that the receiving technique and the ability to move in a mobile manner after receiving the ball, combined with sticks. I mean, sticks are just rock hard now. They're so stiff. And kids like to have them, the stiffer the better, because they can hit the ball harder, or they think they can hit the ball harder. The problem is they can't trap it to hit it. And because when the ball touches it, when they trap it, it bounces off by 15 centimetres or 20 centimetres. And they spend the next 2 seconds trying to get the ball into a place where they can make a pass. It's very frustrating. I mean, wooden sticks allowed you to receive the ball. I remember Stephen Davies, who was a great striker for Australia in 1999. We actually took him away from a synthetic stick and put him onto a wooden stick, and he had the best season of his life. He was a great player, but he was actually able to keep the ball right on his blade, which is part of the art of playing in the modern game, really.
We'll be talking to Mike Smith from the Hockey Museum again. We've spoken to him recently, but speaking to him about the stick development over the years and where we've gone from and what we have now. I don't think you can get a wooden stick anymore, can you?
You can, yeah, you can, but you've got to know where to go to get them. It's not as though young kids are going to find those in the stores. They're all synthetic now, and as I say, people want to, you know, if you can get a $400 stick versus a $200 stick, the kids all want the $400 stick because it's better, you know? And all it is just got a lot more hardened synthetic material in it, so it's really, really, really stiff. Quite honestly, if I was to give some advice to young kids, I'd be picking the $50 stick, one that's got a little bit of flex in it. I think you'd find that they'd be able to play the game a little more effectively.
Do you know of any top players today that have got that sort of composition on their sticks?
Yeah, a few of the players use slightly softened sticks, but most of them, the base level of stick is just rock hard, you know, just hard as you can get. And of course, for those who have been around our game for a long time, remember the almost like the cricket handle grip that went through the top of the hockey sticks, and you could bend it, the stick would just move as you leant on it, and then you started to move away from that. And Hazel was very big, you know, with the Griffin stick. Initially, I remember he used to carry bundles of hardener and all this carbon fiber just to stiffen sticks up everywhere. And yeah, he used to love playing with a really stiff stick, but to compare today, today's world of hockey sticks, they're all like that and more. You know, they're just really rigid. And the control mechanism, being able to play the game with a lot of control, is much harder today than with a really rigid stick than it is with a softer stick. And not for 1 minute am I saying going back to the 40s and the 50s where the sticks used to sort of swivel in your hand. But I think there is a sensible blend there. I really do.
Terry, it's been fantastic talking to you today. We could go on for hours, but we've got to wrap things up at some stage. But I did have one more question I wanted to ask you. You're a phenomenal goal scorer, and you know a fair bit about the game. I've spent my entire career, except for the last 2 years, playing in the back line, and I suddenly find myself thrust into the forward line at 50 years of age. And I've just discovered that when you're in the forward line, people expect you to score goals, which is not something I've ever been used to doing before. Have you got any tips?
Excuse me. A 50-year-old playing in this in the front. Well, I would take a strong tablet with humility in it, and I would not try to hit the ball hard. I would just try to get the ball going towards the goal, and I would not have any great expectation. I would just put enjoyment in front of expectation, and you'd be surprised if you do a few simple things, you can do okay. I mean, if you just don't try to move too much and stay relatively stationary, and let the ball come to you, you'll be surprised how often you'll score if you're patient rather than running. 50-year-old running is not as easy as a 20-year-old running. So you use up a lot of energy and ability as you're moving.
Oh, look, Terry, it's been tremendous talking to you. All the best. I think you finish up with Malaysia sometime this year, do you?
Yeah, well, we've got a couple of World League Threes that we're going to. Our women have miraculously got into the World League Three, in my view, but they've done a very, very good job. They've just got five to six years of development to go before they can legitimately, in my view, take on the best teams in the world. But they're in there, and they're giving it a go. And the men's team, I think, are pretty reasonable. If they get things right, they can be a real threat on the international scene. That all happens over the next couple of weeks. And the Australian girls are in the same tournament in Brussels as the Malaysian girls, and the Australian men are in Africa, which is not the tournament that the Malaysian men are in.
Okay. We actually need to get someone on from the FIH to explain to us the whole World Hockey League, because it can be a bit confusing at times.
Well, yeah, it is a confusing setup, but in simple terms, the way it runs today is not the way it's going to run tomorrow, so it's probably not necessarily worthwhile going through it. But in simple terms, at the moment, we have World League 1, World League 2, World League 3, and World League 4. World League 4 is the final one. There's only 8 teams in that, and they're the top 4 teams from the World League 3 tournaments, which there are 2 of. And then underneath the World League 3, there are usually 4 World League 2s, and then there's an infinite number of World League 1s that take place to get you into World League 2. And that takes place over a 2-year cycle. So you have a World Cup to an Olympic cycle, and then an Olympic to a World Cup cycle, those 2-year periods. And that's simply what it is. The World League 1s and the World League 2s take place in the first year of the cycle, and World League 3, World League 4 take place in the second year of the cycle. Yep. So that's where we are right now, and that falls before the next Olympic Games, or the next World Cup. So for us, 2017, you'll have World League 3 and World League 4, and then the World Cup will be in 2018.
And then it's a bit of a watch this space for the new home and away concept.
Yeah, which will be very, very interesting. I'll be very interested to see how that all pans out into the future, because that's one of these exercises in putting a lot of people onto planes.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I keep telling people, especially in this country, Australia, that's something that really kills our ability to promote these sorts of events and get them going, is the travel factor is just so enormous.
Yeah, well, I think that, I mean, the premise is that you'll get a lot of people to come and watch the event because you're playing home and away. And I'd like to think that that was the case, that you might be able to bring in 10,000 or 15,000 people to watch an event. I'm just not convinced that that's going to take place in some of these countries that are going to be involved. But I hope let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. I really hope it's successful and hockey can take another step into the future. But the world is evolving and the world is changing, as we all know, and so is hockey.
Look, Terry, there's so much more we wanted to talk to you about today. There is, honestly, your CV is huge. We've barely scratched the surface. Perhaps in the future we can have another chat to you and discuss some of the issues that we didn't quite get to today.
No problem. Look, thanks for your time, and thanks for your interest, and thanks for what you do for our sport. It's fantastic. Good on you.
Thanks, Terry.
Cheers, Terry.
Cheers.